At an unusually late age, he had lost his heart for the first time to a lady more renowned for beauty than constancy. Rosita Thiessen claimed, with perfect truth, to have the blood of Manchu emperors flowing in her veins. She still possessed many subjects, including most of the faculty of science at Cape. Jan had been taken prisoner by her delicate, flower-like beauty, and the affair had proceeded far enough to make its termination all the more galling. He could not imagine what had gone wrong. He would get over it, of course. Other men had survived similar catastrophes without irreparable damage, had even reached the stage when they could say, "I'm sure I could never have been really serious about a woman like that." But such detachment still lay far in the future, and at the moment, Jan was very much at odds with life. His other grievance was less easily remedied, for it concerned the impact of the overlords upon his own ambitions. Jan was a romantic not only in heart, but in mind. Like so many other young men since the conquest of the air had been assured, he had let his dreams and his imagination roam the unexplored seas of space. A century before, man had set foot upon the ladder that could lead him to the stars. At that very moment, could it have been coincidence? The door to the planets had been slammed in his face. The overlords had imposed few positive bans on any form of human activity. The conduct of war was perhaps the major exception. But research into spaceflight had virtually ceased. The challenge presented by the science of the overlords was too great. For the moment, at least, man had lost heart and had turned to other fields of activity. There was no point in developing rockets when the overlords had infinitely superior means of propulsion, based on principles of which they had never given any hint. A few hundred men had visited the moon for the purpose of establishing a lunar observatory. They had traveled as passengers in a small vessel loaned by the overlords and driven by rockets. It was obvious that little could be learned from a study of this primitive vehicle, even if its owners handed it over without reservation to inquisitive terrestrial scientists. Man was, therefore, still a prisoner on his own planet. It was a much fairer, but a much smaller, planet than it had been a century before. When the overlords had abolished war and hunger and disease, they had also abolished adventure. The rising moon was beginning to paint the eastern sky with a pale, milky glow. Up there, Jan knew, was the main base of the overlords, lying within the ramparts of Plato. Though the supply ships must have been coming and going for more than 70 years, it was only in Jan's lifetime that all concealment had been dropped, and they had made their departure in clear sight of Earth. In the 200-inch telescope, the shadows of the great ships could be clearly seen when the morning or evening sun cast them for miles across the lunar plains. Since everything that the overlords did was of immense interest to mankind, a careful watch was kept of their comings and goings, and the pattern of their behavior, though not the reason for it, was beginning to emerge. One of those great shadows had vanished a few hours ago. That meant, Jan knew, that somewhere off the moon an overlord ship was lying in space, carrying out whatever routine was necessary before it began its journey to its distant, unknown home. He had never seen one of those returning ships launch itself towards the stars. If conditions were good, the sight was visible over half the world. But Jan had always been unlucky. One could never tell exactly when the takeoff would be, and the overlords did not advertise the fact. He decided he would wait another 10 minutes, then rejoin the party. What was that? Only a meteor sliding down through Eridanus. Jan relaxed, discovered his cigarette had gone out, and lit another. He was halfway through it when, 500,000 kilometers away, the star drive went on. Up from the heart of the spreading moon glow, a tiny spark began to climb towards the zenith. At first, its movement was so slow that it could hardly be perceived, but second by second it was gaining speed. As it climbed, it increased in brilliance, then suddenly faded from sight. A moment later, it had reappeared, gaining speed and brightness. Waxing and waning with a peculiar rhythm, it ascended ever more swiftly into the sky, drawing a fluctuating line of light across the stars. Even if one did not know its real distance, the impression of speed was breathtaking. When one knew that the departing ship was somewhere beyond the moon, the mind reeled at the speeds and energies involved. It was an unimportant byproduct of those energies, Jan knew, that he was seeing now. The ship itself was invisible, already far ahead of that ascending light. As a high-flying jet may leave a vapor trail behind it, so the outward-bound vessel of the overlords left its own peculiar wake. The generally accepted theory, and there seemed little doubt of its truth, was that the immense accelerations of the star drive caused a local distortion of space. What Jan was seeing, he knew, was nothing less than the light of distant stars, collected and focused into his eye whenever conditions were favorable along the track of the ship. It was a visible proof of relativity, the bending of light in the presence of a colossal gravitational field. Now, the end of that vast, pencil-thin lens seemed to be moving more slowly, but that was only due to perspective. In reality, the ship was still gaining speed. Its path was merely being foreshortened as it hurled itself outwards to the stars. There would be many telescopes following it, Jan knew, as Earth's scientists tried to uncover the secrets of the drive. Dozens of papers had already been published on the subject. No doubt the overlords had read them with the greatest interest. The phantom light was beginning to wane. Now it was a fading streak, pointing to the heart of the constellation Carina, as Jan had known that it would. The home of the overlords was somewhere out there, but it might circle any one of a thousand stars in that sector of space. There was no way of telling its distance from the solar system. It was all over. Though the ship had scarcely begun its journey, there was nothing more that human eyes could see. But in Jan's mind, the memory of that shining path still burned, a beacon that would never fade as long as he possessed ambition and desire. The party was over. Almost all the guests had climbed back into the sky and were now scattering to the four corners of the globe. There were, however, a few exceptions. One was Norman Dodsworth, the poet, who had got unpleasantly drunk but had been sensible enough to pass out before any violent action proved necessary. He had been deposited, not very gently, on the lawn, where it was hoped that a hyena would give him a rude awakening. For all practical purposes, he could, therefore, be regarded as absent. The other remaining guests were George and Jean. This was not George's idea at all. He wanted to go home. He disapproved of the friendship between Rupert and Jean, though not for the usual reason. George prided himself on being a practical, level-headed character, and regarded the interest which drew Jean and Rupert together as being not only childish in this age of science, but more than a little unhealthy. That anyone should still place the slightest credence in the supernormal seemed extraordinary to him, and finding Rashavarik here had shaken his faith in the overlords. It was now obvious that Rupert had been plotting some surprise, probably with Jean's connivance. George resigned himself gloomily to whatever nonsense was coming. "I tried all sorts of things before I settled on this," said Rupert proudly. "The big problem is to reduce friction so that you get complete freedom of movement. The old-fashioned polished table and tumbler setup isn't bad, but it's been used for centuries now, and I was sure that modern science could do better. And here's the result. Draw up your chairs. Are you quite sure you don't want to join, Rashi?" The overlord seemed to hesitate for a fraction of a second. Then he shook his head. Had they learned that habit on Earth? George wondered.
"No, thank you," he replied. "I would prefer to observe. Some other time, perhaps."
"Very well. There's plenty of time to change your mind later."
"Oh, is there?" thought George, looking gloomily at his watch. Rupert had shepherded his friends round a small but massive table, perfectly circular in shape. It had a flat plastic top, which he lifted off to reveal a glittering sea of closely packed ball bearings. They were prevented from escaping by the table's slightly raised rim, and George found it quite impossible to imagine their purpose. The hundreds of reflected points of light formed a fascinating and hypnotic pattern, and he felt himself becoming slightly dizzy. As they drew up their chairs, Rupert reached under the table and brought forth a disc some 10 centimeters in diameter, which he placed on the surface of the ball bearings.
"There you are," he said. "You put your fingers on this, and it moves around with no resistance at all."
George eyed the device with profound distrust. He noted that the letters of the alphabet were placed at regular intervals, though in no particular order, round the circumference of the table. In addition, there were the numbers 1 to 9, scattered at random among the letters, and 2 cards bearing the words yes and no. These were on opposite sides of the table.
"It looks like a lot of mumbo-jumbo to me," he muttered. "I'm surprised that anyone takes it seriously in this age."
He felt a little better after delivering this mild protest, which was aimed at Jean quite as much as Rupert. Rupert didn't pretend to have more than a detached scientific interest in these phenomena. He was open-minded, but not credulous. Jean, on the other hand, well, George was sometimes a little worried about her. She really seemed to think that there was something in this business of telepathy and second sight. Not until he had made his remark did George realize that it also implied a criticism of Rashavarik. He glanced nervously round, but the Overlord showed no reaction, which of course proved absolutely nothing at all. Everyone had now taken up their positions. Going in a clockwise direction round the table were Rupert, Maya, Jan, Jean, George, and Benny Schoenberger. Ruth Schoenberger was sitting outside the circle with a notebook. She apparently had some objection to taking part in the proceedings, which had caused Benny to make obscurely sarcastic remarks about people who still took the Talmud seriously. However, she seemed perfectly willing to act as a recorder.
"Now listen," began Rupert. "For the benefit of skeptics like George, let's get this quite straight. Whether or not there's anything supernormal about this, it works. Personally, I think there's a purely mechanical explanation. When we put our hands on the disc, even though we may try to avoid influencing its movements, our subconscious starts playing tricks. I've analyzed lots of these seances, and I've never got answers that someone in the group mightn't have known or guessed, though sometimes they weren't aware of the fact. However, I'd like to carry out the experiment in these rather, peculiar circumstances."
The peculiar circumstance sat watching them silently, but doubtless not with indifference. George wondered just what Rashavarik thought of these antics. Were his reactions those of an anthropologist watching some primitive religious rite? The whole setup was really quite fantastic, and George felt as big a fool as he had ever done in his life. If the others felt equally foolish, they concealed their emotions. Only Jean looked flushed and excited, though that might have been the drinks.
"All set?" asked Rupert. "Very well."
He paused impressively. Then, addressing no one in particular, he called out,
"Is there anybody there?"
George could feel the plate beneath his fingers tremble slightly. That was not surprising, considering the pressure being exerted upon it by the 6 people in the circle. It slithered around in a small figure 8, then came to rest back at the center.
"Is there anybody there?" repeated Rupert.
In a more conversational tone of voice, he added, "It's often 10 or 15 minutes before we get started, but sometimes..."
"Hush,"
breathed Jean. The plate was moving. It began to swing in a wide arc between the cards labeled yes and no. With some difficulty, George suppressed a giggle. Just what would it prove, he wondered, if the answer was no? He remembered the old joke, "There's nobody here but us chickens, massa." But the answer was yes. The plate came swiftly back to the center of the table. Somehow it now seemed alive, waiting for the next question. Despite himself, George began to be impressed.
"Who are you?" asked Rupert.
There was no hesitation now as the letters were spelled out. The plate darted across the table like a sentient thing, moving so swiftly that George sometimes found it hard to keep his fingers in contact. He could swear that he was not contributing to its motion. Glancing quickly round the table, he could see nothing suspicious in the faces of his friends. They seemed as intent and as expectant as he himself.
"I am all,"
spelled the plate, and returned to its point of equilibrium.
I am all, repeated Rupert. That's a typical reply, evasive yet stimulating. It probably means that there's nothing here except our combined minds.
He paused for a moment, obviously deciding upon his next question. Then he addressed the air once more.
Have you a message for anyone here?
No,
replied the plate promptly. Rupert looked around the table.
It's up to us. Sometimes it volunteers information, but this time we'll have to ask definite questions. Anyone like to start?
Will it rain tomorrow? Said George jestingly. At once, the little plate began to swing back and forth in the yes-no line.
That's a silly question, reproved Rupert. It's bound to be raining somewhere, and to be dry somewhere else. Don't ask questions that have ambiguous answers.
George felt appropriately squashed. He decided to let someone else have the next turn.
What is my favorite color? Asked Maya.
Blue, came the prompt reply.
That's quite correct. But it doesn't prove anything. At least three people here knew that, George pointed out. What's Ruth's favorite color? Asked Benny.
Red.
Is that right, Ruth?
The recorder looked up from her notebook.
Yes, it is. But Benny knows that, and he's in the circle.
I didn't know, retorted Benny.
You darn well ought to. I've told you enough times. Subconscious memory, murmured Rupert. That often happens. But can we have some more intelligent questions, please? Now that this has started so well, I don't want it to peter out.
Curiously enough, the very triviality of the phenomenon was beginning to impress George. He was sure that there was no supernormal explanation. As Rupert had said, the plate was simply responding to their unconscious muscular movements. But this fact in itself was surprising and impressive. He would never have believed that such precise, swift replies could have been obtained. Once he tried to see if he could influence the board by making it spell out his own name. He got the G, but that was all. The rest was nonsense. It was virtually impossible, he decided, for one person to take control without the remainder of the circle knowing it. After half an hour, Ruth had taken down more than a dozen messages, some of them quite long ones. There were occasional spelling mistakes and curiosities of grammar, but they were few. Whatever the explanation, George was not convinced that he was not contributing consciously to the results. Several times, as a word was being spelt out, he had anticipated the next letter and hence the meaning of the message, and on each occasion the plate had gone in a quite unexpected direction and spelt something totally different. Sometimes, indeed, since there was no pause to indicate the end of one word and the beginning of the next, the entire message was meaningless until it was complete and Ruth had read it back. The whole experience gave George an uncanny impression of being in contact with some purposeful, independent mind. And yet there was no conclusive proof one way or the other. The replies were so trivial, so ambiguous. What, for example, could one make of, "Believe in man, nature is with you"? Yet sometimes there were suggestions of profound, even disturbing truths. "Remember, man is not alone, near man is country of others." But of course everyone knew that. Though could one be sure that the message merely referred to the overlords? George was growing very sleepy. It was high time, he thought drowsily, that they headed for home. This was all very intriguing, but it wasn't getting them anywhere, and you could have too much of a good thing. He glanced around the table. Benny looked as if he might be feeling the same way. Maya and Rupert both appeared slightly glazed, and Jean... well, she had been taking it too seriously all along. Her expression worried George. It was almost as if she were afraid to stop, yet afraid to go on. That left only Jan. George wondered what he thought of his brother-in-law's eccentricities. The young engineer had asked no questions, shown no surprise at any of the answers. He seemed to be studying the movement of the plate as if it was just another scientific phenomenon. Rupert roused himself from the lethargy into which he appeared to have fallen.
"Let's have one more question," he said. "Then we'll call it a day. What about you, Jan? You've not asked anything."
Surprisingly, Jan never hesitated. It was as if he had made his choice a long time ago and had been waiting for the opportunity. He glanced once at the impassive bulk of Rashavarik, then called out in a clear, steady voice, "Which star is the Overlord's sun?" Rupert checked a whistle of surprise. Maya and Benny showed no reaction at all. Jean had closed her eyes and seemed to be asleep. Rashavarik had leaned forward so that he could look down into the circle over Rupert's shoulder. And the plate began to move. When it came to rest again, there was a brief pause. Then Ruth asked, in a puzzled voice, "What does NGS-549672 mean?" She got no reply, for at the same moment George called out anxiously, "Give me a hand with Jean. I'm afraid she's fainted." Chapter 9.
"This man, Boyce," said Karelin. "Tell me all about him."
The supervisor did not use those actual words, of course, and the thoughts he really expressed were far more subtle. A human listener would have heard a short burst of rapidly modulated sound, not unlike a high-speed Morse sender in action. Though many samples of Overlord language had been recorded, they all defied analysis because of their extreme complexity. The speed of transmission made it certain that no interpreter, even if he had mastered the elements of the language, could ever keep up with the Overlords in their normal conversation. The supervisor for Earth stood with his back to Rashavarik, staring out across the multicolored gulf of the Grand Canyon. 10 kilometers away, yet scarcely veiled by distance, the terraced walls were catching the full force of the sun. Hundreds of meters down the shadowed slope at whose brim Karelin stood, a mule train was slowly winding its way into the valley's depths. It was strange, Karelin thought, that so many human beings still seized every opportunity for primitive behavior. They could reach the bottom of the canyon in a fraction of the time, and in far greater comfort, if they chose. Yet they preferred to be jolted along tracks which were probably as unsafe as they looked. Karelin made an imperceptible gesture with his hand. The great panorama faded from view, leaving only a shadowy blankness of indeterminate depth. The realities of his office and of his position crowded in upon the supervisor once more.
"Rupert Boyce is a somewhat curious character," Rashavarik answered. "Professionally, he's in charge of animal welfare over an important section of the main African reservation. He's quite efficient and interested in his work. Because he has to keep watch over several thousand square kilometers, he has one of the 15 panoramic viewers we've so far issued on loan, with the usual safeguards, of course. It is, incidentally, the only one with full projection facilities. He was able to make a good case for these, so we let him have them."
What was his argument?
"He wanted to appear to various wild animals, so that they could get used to seeing him, and so wouldn't attack when he was physically present. The theory has worked out quite well with animals that rely on sight rather than smell, though he'll probably get killed eventually. And of course, there was another reason why we let him have the apparatus."
"It made him more cooperative."
"Precisely. I originally contacted him because he has one of the world's finest libraries of books on parapsychology and allied subjects. He politely but firmly refused to lend any of them, so there was nothing to do but to visit him. I've now read about half his library. It has been a considerable ordeal."
"That I can well believe," said Karelin dryly. "Have you discovered anything among all the rubbish?"
"Yes. 11 clear cases of partial breakthrough, and 27 probables. The material is so selective, however, that one cannot use it for sampling purposes, and the evidence is confused with mysticism, perhaps the prime aberration of the human mind."
"And what is Boyce's attitude to all this?"
"He pretends to be open-minded and skeptical, but it's clear that he would never have spent so much time and effort in this field unless he had some subconscious faith. I challenged him on this, and he admitted that I was probably right. He would like to find some convincing proof. That is why he is always carrying out these experiments, even though he pretends that they are only games."
"You are sure he doesn't suspect that your interest is more than academic?"
"Quite sure. In many ways, Boyce is remarkably obtuse and simple-minded. That makes his attempts to do research in this, of all fields, rather pathetic. There is no need to take any special action regarding him.
I see. And what about the girl who fainted?
This is the most exciting feature of the entire affair. Jean Morrill was, almost certainly, the channel through which the information came. But she is 26, far too old to be a prime contact herself, judging by all our previous experience. It must, therefore, be someone closely linked to her. The conclusion is obvious. We cannot have many more years to wait. We must transfer her to Category Purple. She may be the most important human being alive.
I will do that.
And what of the young man who asked the question?
Was it random curiosity, or did he have some other motive? It was chance that brought him there. His sister has just married Rupert Boyce. He had never met any of the other guests before. I am sure the question was unpremeditated, being inspired by the unusual conditions, and probably by my presence. Given these factors, it is hardly surprising that he acted in the way he did. His great interest is astronautics. He is secretary of the space travel group at Cape Town University, and obviously intends to make this field his life study.
His career should be interesting. Meanwhile, what action do you think he will take, and what shall we do about him?
He will undoubtedly make some checks as soon as he can, but there is no way in which he can prove the accuracy of his information, and because of its peculiar origin, he is hardly likely to publish it. Even if he does, will it affect matters in the slightest?
I will have both situations evaluated, Karelin replied.
Though it is part of our directive not to reveal our base, there is no way in which the information could be used against us.
I agree.
Roderick will have some information which is of doubtful truth, and of no practical value.
So it would seem, said Karelin.
But let us not be too certain. Human beings are remarkably ingenious, and often very persistent. It is never safe to underrate them, and it will be interesting to follow Mr. Roderick's career. I must think about this further.
Rupert Boyce never really got to the bottom of it. When his guests had departed, rather less boisterously than usual, he had thoughtfully rolled the table back into its corner. The mild alcoholic fog prevented any profound analysis of what had happened, and even the actual facts were already slightly blurred. He had a vague idea that something of great but elusive importance had happened, and wondered if he should discuss it with Rashavarik. On second thought, he decided it might be tactless. After all, his brother-in-law had caused the trouble, and Rupert felt vaguely annoyed with young Jan. But was it Jan's fault? Was it anybody's fault? Rather guiltily, Rupert remembered that it had been his experiment. He decided, fairly successfully, to forget the whole business. Perhaps he might have done something if the last page of Ruth's notebook could have been found, but it had vanished in the confusion. Jan always feigned innocence, and, well, one could hardly accuse Rashavarik, and no one could ever remember exactly what had been spelled out, except that it didn't seem to make any sense. The person most immediately affected had been George Gregson. He could never forget his feeling of terror as Jean pitched into his arms. Her sudden helplessness transformed her in that moment from an amusing companion to an object of tenderness and affection. Women had fainted, not always without forethought, since time immemorial, and men had invariably responded in the desired way. Jean's collapse was completely spontaneous, but it could not have been better planned. In that instant, as he realized later, George came to one of the most important decisions of his life. Jean was definitely the girl who mattered, despite her queer ideas and queerer friends. He had no intention of totally abandoning Naomi or Joy or Elsa or, what was her name, Denise. But the time had come for something more permanent. He had no doubt that Jean would agree with him, for her feelings had been quite obvious from the start. Behind his decision, there was another factor of which he was unaware. Tonight's experience had wakened his contempt and skepticism for Jean's peculiar interests. He would never recognize the fact, but it was so, and it had removed the last barrier between them. He looked at Jean as she lay, pale but composed, in the reclining chair of the flyer. There was darkness below, stars above. George had no idea to within 1,000 kilometers where they might be, nor did he care. That was the business of the robot that was guiding them homewards and would land them in, so the control board announced, 57 minutes from now.